Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Earlier in the show, we heard Ear Hustle podcast producer Erlon Woods talk about his transition to normal life after 2 decades in prison in California. That transition from prisoner to free person can be challenging, but so can the transition from many life circumstances to the next.
Take professional sports. For many pro athletes, by the time they retire or are forced from the game by injury or obsolescence, they've been in their sport for 20 or 30 years. And for too many of them, they find it difficult, financially, emotionally, or both, to adjust to life after sports.
Robert Turner has devoted his life since leaving pro football to figuring out why that's the case. Turner earned a PhD in sociology and now teaches in the School of Medicine and Health Sciences at George Washington University. He is the author of a new book called Not For Long, The Life and Career of the NFL Athlete, based on research he did for his dissertation. He joined us in the studio recently. Welcome back to Lake Effect. It is a delight to have you here.
It's great. Actually, this is the first time that I've ever returned back to a place that I did an interview before. So this is a great experience for me, especially since you saw the early version from my dissertation.
We are honored. So this is kind of a strange place to start, but it kind of sets everything in motion. Tell me about the day you were cut from the San Francisco 49ers.
Yeah, that's definitely. So that day was, you know, and a lot of different reasons, that was the biggest day of my life. Essentially, that was the day that I was confronted with the reality that my football career was over. You know, after 16 years of playing, from the time I was in, you know, Pop Warner football to high school to college, and then I played 4 years professionally on different teams across 3 different leagues. And when I sat there, you know, it's funny, it was a very strange thing. The night before, I actually was thinking to myself, yeah, I had a great practice, and I said, you know, but I was also playing for the 49ers, you know, they were Super Bowl champs at the time. And I said, if when it's time for me to go, I'll be satisfied knowing that I have played the best that I can. I gave it all on the field. I didn't know that the next morning they called me into the office and said, okay, thank you, but no thank you. And then, you know, he asked me that question, where do you want to go? And at that moment, everything just, my heart sank. I started getting cold sweats. I couldn't hear because I realized what he was saying and how I knew what it meant is that my career was done. What do you want to do next in your life? And I had no answer to that question, and I wasn't prepared to answer it. And so, you know, for that moment, I didn't know where I wanted to go. So I asked him if I could take the night, think about it, and then get back to him at that point. And that was really the start of a very long journey to try to figure out what football had meant to me and how do I kind of disconnect my identity from this football identity.
Right. He was asking, you know, what airport do you want to fly
exactly.
to? And at the same time, when you hear the question, it dawns on you, you've got to figure out really just what's next in a bigger sense.
Absolutely. And the thing about it, for this book at least, when I did the research initially in graduate school as part of my dissertation, I didn't write about myself in the book about that at all. But my mentor and really dear friend, one of my mentors, Dr. Carol Stack, who's an emeritus from Duke and UC Berkeley, she said, if you're going to write this book, there's 3 things you have to do. One, you have to write about yourself. The second thing you have to do is you have to write about race. And the third thing, if you need to write about gender, right, masculinity. And I didn't want to touch any of those. So she made me put this whole story about myself squarely in the middle of it. And that really is what this whole book is about.
Well, and so we spoke, and I think it was we figured out 9 years ago while this was in the process of coming together as your dissertation, you were at Marquette University doing a lot of the groundwork for what became this book. Once you got to the point where it went from dissertation to what's in front of us today, was there a single overarching question you were trying to answer or issue you wanted to illuminate above everything else?
Yes. I didn't realize it at the time when I did all of the dissertation work, when I did all the field work, when I wrote up all the notes, and even when I wrote the first, you know, what I submitted as my dissertation work, I didn't realize that the book was really about why do athletes struggle with their transition to life after football? But conversely, it also meant that how did some people make successful transitions to life after football? And so the book gives you a couple of examples. And I think that all of us are at points in our lives where we hit those crises and we ask ourselves, what do we do now? What happens when the roof crumbles in and we weren't prepared for it, but we have to keep on keeping on? And that's really, I think, what these athletes can give us a sense of. What happens when you plan your whole life to be successful and you actually finally do get that brass ring, but then that ring slips slips through your fingers. What do you do next?
Well, and so let's talk about some of the things that set the foundation for all of that, starting with youth sports. And I'm not sure exactly how old you are, but I imagine we are fairly close to being contemporaries here. Youth sports, when we were kids, did not seem to be a part of the sports industrial complex as they are today. What happened to youth sports?
Well, I think, and that's a good point. I really do emphasize that, you know, the whole sports industrialization complex that we talk about. What we have today is the professionalization of youth sports. You know, I was flabbergasted, you know, 20, 30 years ago when Tommy John had his surgery, maybe longer than that for those who are, you know, historians would know. That was revolutionary surgery at the time that helped his career. I've been told lately that actually some families have used a Tommy John surgery as elective surgery for their kids today to prolong their careers over time in baseball. And so we have pressures today on young people that we've never seen before. I guess the most real example is lately is where we see that the University of Michigan, Jim Harbaugh, just offered a seventh grader a scholarship to play quarterback at the University of Michigan. I don't make that mistake. And so kids have a lot of pressure. Think about being the kid who received that scholarship offer, what he has to live up to. But even more importantly, think about the tens of thousands of kids who read that, hear it, and then they wonder, what about me? What does it say about me at this age? And the pressure that they put themselves under.
Well, and youth sports is also a time at which race and socioeconomic factors really come into the kinds of opportunities that kids have as well.
Well, absolutely. I was just writing an op-ed piece about this very thing. You know, there was a piece in The Atlantic. I don't know if you read about it. They quoted me in there, and they wanted to understand why is it – are we having this kind of break where more African-American kids or kids from lower socioeconomic background will wind up playing football because wealthier kids and white kids, their families will be removing them from football because of, you know, the head concussions, which I think is a little curious because the one thing that we also see at the same exact time is over the last 20 years, hockey has been growing in sports, and they're not growing with black kids. They're growing with a lot of white kids. So I think it's more than the fears about concussions, but we definitely see today with the youth sports and the professionalization, their families are paying upwards of $6,000, $7,000, $10,000 for private lessons, coaching, facilities, all of these different things. It's really a story about the have and the have not so often.
Well, and you write about, I think, you know, a former player who wanted to start a number of football camps and really try to offer some of the same kinds of opportunities for players of color, but was confronted with the reality that, you know, these are families that and high school teams that really can't afford to pay much in order to be able to tap into, like, former NFL talents.
Well, that was really one of, the most striking experiences for me in writing the book with Odessa Turner, who's the athlete you're talking about. When we went out to Connecticut, and we wanted to work with a couple of teams, their inner city team and as well as a rural team. And both of them said, we don't have the money, but what we have is a lot of enthusiasm and our kids really need you to come out there. So Odessa realized he couldn't work for free, but he really cut it down significantly on what the costs were. And that showed us that there were a lot of kids there. Ironically, the white kid that was on an all-black team, he was the one that said, I'm playing football because I need a scholarship and there's no other way that I can get to college but through this. But we also see, and I write about this in the book as well, is there's Test Sports, which was in New Jersey, Martinsville, New Jersey, which is a well-economic, very wealthy place. Their parents were paying all kinds of money for them to get personalized lessons from former NFL athletes. And so we see how race and class are all over sports in America today.
Well, and so then let's talk about football at the high school and college level. And one of the revelations that came to me is that, you know, for a sport that requires its players to have a really smart grasp of some very complex offensive and defensive plays and really be able to think while they're on the field and act while they're on the field, players are not really encouraged to think or do for themselves off the field.
Well, that I agree with. I write about that very much in the book. I think that there are plenty of people in the NCAA who would want to argue vehemently against that. There are people at where I wrote, you know, a lot of the book and did a lot of discussions and data collection at UNC in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, that would tell you otherwise. But I think it bears out to be true. The one thing that we know, as far as I'm concerned, that I will argue, is that athletes, particularly in the revenue-generating sports, and even more so we shine a light on football, they are discouraged from thinking critically. It's not that they're discouraged from thinking, but I guess the people running the show don't want the athletes thinking critically and asking questions about who controls and benefits from this institution.
We hear about academic scandals in big-time college sports, and you know, you spoke at length to the whistleblower at UNC.
Mary Whittingham, yes. Exactly.
Right, who exposed the really shady practices that were going on there. What is the cost to the students, you know, who are at least theoretically student-athletes? We hear a lot about, and we think, you know, this is crazy that that these classes don't really exist, or that there are people who are essentially doing work for them. But, you know, when we think about these players' lives after they leave UNC or wherever they've gone to college, what's the cost
country.
Of them? Yeah.
Well, I think the cost starts very, very early, not just in gearing people towards classes where other people might be doing their work, bogus classes altogether, or classes that aren't really challenging them enough. And this is really what I try to do, is build on the work of Dr. Harry Edwards, who is, you know, a famous sociologist, and he's credited with being the father of the sociology of sports in America. And people may know him from the famous boycott back in the Olympics in 1968. And he tried to shed light on some of the injustices in sports back then. And I try to really pick up on the work that he has done. But he argues, and I think it might be still relevant today, it's worth asking the question and really examining. But he says, particularly if you look at football, where 70%, almost 70% of the athletes in the NFL are African-American, black, in NCAA, the numbers are almost as significant, particularly when you're looking at the people who are starters and playing on the field. And so he says it is a drain of resources from those communities where some of your talented, best and brightest are solely focused on making it in sports and using sports as a meritocracy, instead of looking at ways of which they could become doctors, lawyers, dentists, and other significant contributors to the community. So he's not saying that sports is bad, and I'm not at all. I think it's beneficial. I'm a person that's benefited greatly from it. But it's that kind of, I guess, blind commitment and neglect of other areas to pursue of excellence, and that we'd like to see lots of young men and young women who turn to sports as that means for upward mobility.
Well, and so you're right that by the time most players, if they are good enough, make it to the NFL, you know, sort of years of social conditioning have put them in this position where they're really only prepared for life on the field. But that's most. You did, as you said at the beginning of this interview, speak with some players and former players who, against the odds, it seems, were actually better prepared than others. Players like, I think it was a former Packers wide receiver, Derek Mays. What puts some of these players in this position where they are actually able to succeed once their playing career is over?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned Derek. He's a great friend. I got to know Derek actually well before I came to Milwaukee at Marquette. And I didn't realize how this would all kind of come together. But Derek, I write about him in the book primarily. He's a great example. Derek's mom was a high school teacher. She had taught several football players before her. So she understood how, and this is what I really argue this point in the book, is that people say, well, is the NCAA the Gestapo, so to speak? And I have my opinions about that. But what I will say is that in college sports, particularly revenue generating sports, they will exploit vulnerable athletes. If you, particularly a first generation athlete, you're looking in sports for to be your ticket out, you may very well get taken advantage of. The nice thing about Derek's story is that his mom, being a teacher, she understood that his education was primary and made it a very large focus in the household. Derek also comes from a household where his father was an entrepreneur, a small business owner. Derek was taught very early in his life that you will never get truly ahead as long as you are working for a paycheck. You need to be able to build your own thing. So his family, he famously told me that his mom said, "You're going to Notre Dame." no matter where else you might think you might want to go, but in the Notre Dame degree, the Notre Dame network, and if you're lucky enough to play in the NFL, all of those things together will give you advantages in life that you will never be able to get anyplace else. And that's exactly how Derek lives his life today. And the other thing I would say real quickly on that, what makes his success, I think, so good is that he played for Coach Lou Holtz. And he shared with me, he said what Lou Holtz would tell the team all the time, all the resources that you need to be successful in life are within your arm's length. All you have to do is go out and grab them or ask for them, and you can be successful on your own terms. And so I think that Derek, you know, that maybe oversimplifies, but he's an example of someone who actually did transition out very well.
What were the things that made the difference for you? You went to James Madison, which at the time was a 1AA school and is now the FCS school.
Still 1AA FCS, but yes, exactly. Yeah. But they're a powerhouse on that level, yes.
Yeah, but you were able to obviously recognize the importance of education all the while you were coming into your own.
I would say, you know, I wish it were so easy. I would say that things happened for me I just felt so blessed. I mean, I really feel that my faith is very important. God blessed me in ways that I had no idea. But Coach Challis Joe McMillan, when he recruited us way back in the day, and on that team we had over 7 guys that played in the NFL, one of which probably people know the most is Charles Haley, who's in the Hall of Fame, but Gary Clark, Scott Notwood, all of us. And the coach, when he came into our house, he looked at each one of us and said to our parents and to us personally, you will graduate from James Madison. And when I had some rough times, he called me in the office and said, do you remember I promised your parents that you would graduate? Now, the great thing about him is that he meant not just graduate with a degree, but he meant you will receive a good college education when you come here. And that was, I guess, the foundation of a lot of things so that I could kind of fall back on over the years when I was lost, and I write about it in a book, and I didn't know what I was going to do. Very fortunate that I come from a very strong family that were behind me 100%. But, you know, where Coach told us that education was really important, I think those are the things that years later after I finished playing football that led me to go back and to get a PhD.
For the 4 years you played professionally and the years it took to write the dissertation and then take the dissertation and make it into a book, are you conflicted at all when you watch football today?
No, not at all. Because I think that there's a lot of reasons that people play football. And I've had the great fortune in this book. It was a 4-year ethnography, so I lived with football players. I lived with their families. I've watched them make decisions on where to live, how to raise their kids. I've seen a lot. I've interviewed 140 people. I know what this game means. I spent a lot of time with former players. I know what this game means to people. I know, and football players know what the risks are involved with it, and they're learning more about the risks more than we've ever known. And many people will tell you that, you know, this game transformed their lives in a lot of different ways. What I care about the most is what happens to athletes once they leave the game. What do we need to do to help them become better prepared? What do we need to do to take care of their health if they have health problems after the game? What do we need to do to equip them to be prepared as they go through the sports tournament at the early end so that way they can come out of it with the resources that they need to be successful? So really, I'm all about making the game better, making it safer, and empowering the players that and their families that have gone through this thing.
Think all the football players that, who are leaving the game should get a copy of your book?
I think so. I think that, well, I'll put it this way. My mom, after reading the book, she said 2 things to me that was really great. She said, one, I learned so much more about you, and it answers some questions that I had all these years. But then she also said, after having been a mom that put 2 kids through major college football, and now she has a grandson playing major college football, she said, I think that every kid and every family that has anybody that plays football and by the extension, any sport that goes to college, they need to read your book. And that was a great endorsement from my mom.
Should have had her blurb it on the back.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Robert Turner, it really is a great read. And congratulations on the book and best of luck from here on out.
I appreciate it very much. And thanks again for having me.
Robert Turner is a professor in the School of Medicine and Health Sciences at George Washington University, and he's the author of Not For Long, The Life and Career of the NFL Athlete. Turner played professional football in the now-defunct USFL, in the Canadian Football League, and briefly for the San Francisco 49ers.
The book is based on some of the work he did for his doctoral dissertation, which included a stint at Marquette University. We spoke with him 9 years ago as that work was coming together, and also last week when he was here to speak at Boswell Book Company.